So, wait for the gentleman to come in. So this morning I want to talk about the glorious topic of death. As a friend of mine told me when I said that I was going to talk about, she said, well, that's very interesting. You've been talking a lot about life recently. And I said, ah, yes, but for the Sufi, death is the real business. As Pirzia quoted for us yesterday, the hadith, beloved of all Sufis, to die before you die. This is kind of the, you know, when you sign on the dotted line on the Sufi contract, if you didn't get one, well, you missed it in the mail or whatever, it says, are you prepared to die before you die? And you sign, and if possible, with a bit of blood there, and then on you go. And a lot of people, when they begin the path, don't actually realize. They didn't read that particular bit of fine print. They were kind of like the idea of love and intoxication and sweetness and the beloved. And yeah, that is all part of it. But as the Sufi says, nothing is possible in love without death. And really, we are in the dying business. I mean, that's just not... Let's just go right to basics right away, just to one of my favorite poets, Fakhruddin Iraqi. You will learn about the beloved when yourself is forgotten. You will glance in that direction when you face away from yourself. You will come to live in him when you lose your life. So, yes, we turn away from the beloved, from the world, we look towards God, we turn away from ourselves, but in the end, it is, friends, about death. And death is, for some reason in the American culture, not a popular topic. I don't know why. If you were in Victorian England, you know, you were never allowed to talk about sex, but death was celebrated with gusto, with horses, with plumes, and, you know, you wore mourning for, in black, elegant, you know, Victorian mourning for months, if not years afterwards. But somehow, this century, death is kind of it's under the carpet. You know, people go away to homes to die, and so we have forgotten how to celebrate death, and as we have forgotten. And also, it's not so easy, as many of you may have remembered from past memories, there was a wonderful Sufi practice where you went to sit on the tombstones in the cemetery at night, you know, to do your zikr, to do your meditation. And really that was part of the initial training, you know, for the young people on the path. You know, you found a cemetery and some old tombs, and you sat there and you prayed the night through. And it's not so easy to find those cemeteries now. You know, your village is probably, you know, somebody might get a little bit concerned if they found you meditating on a tombstone at night. And so that whole... So we have to somehow reclaim often this wonderful, wonderful thing of what it means to die before you die. And so I will have a little exploration of what that means, because just as we have sanitized the physical death, often in this secular society, we have also sanitized the spiritual death. And really, there comes a point on the path when, you know, if you are serious, you have to die. And it is kind of a long, slow process. There's no quick euthanasia. It's serious business. It's a serious business. Give a little background. I always say, what is it, sort of spiritual terms, what does it mean to die before you die? It, for most people, when they die, that is when people have had this near-death experience. They go through this tunnel, and at the end of the tunnel, there is this light, and they go towards the light. And people say that light is God, but actually it's the light of one's higher self. It's the light of one's spiritual nature, which you go back towards. For most people, their higher self in a way, their personal God. It is so magnificent. Human beings are so extraordinary, so beautiful, so radiant, so celestial, that as they really are. And that is what you reclaim when you leave the physical, mental, emotional body behind. You go through this tunnel, and there is your real self, what the Zen says, your face before you were born. And you are back together with that, and then the journey continues, of course, because this physical life is just one stage of the journey. And once you reclaim your spiritual self, then you, which is a body of light, then that takes you into dimensions, into realms beyond there, where you continue to have experiences and spiritual training, and the journey unfolds. And I say, for most people, that is, in a way, almost when their spiritual life begins is when they physically die and they regain their light. But as mystics, we aren't prepared to wait until we physically die. Maybe we're too impatient or too greedy, or we remember what it was like to be in that light. So we want to claim that light now as we are embodied in this world. And that presents a really big problem, because in this world you have this thing called an ego and also a nafs, a lower self, and it appears, or you experience it, as separate from your spiritual self, from this light of your real self. And that is where there is the whole drama of tearing apart or dissolving the veils that separate you from yourself. And the Sufis have really, I think, more than any other religion, given a very detailed diagram of that process in the stages of fana, of annihilation. Because what is fana, what is this process of annihilation, but stripping away those veils, the false self, which in the end is everything you think you are. And again, everything you think you are sounds, well, I can get rid of these thoughts that I think I am. But it's not quite as easy as that, because you have to live that tearing away that in this world. And this presents a big, big contradiction inside of yourself. This is where, like my favorite Sufi, Abu Sa'id, said, there has to be blood, there has to be blood. And this is kind of one of the secret inner dramas that takes place. And, you know, when you are physically dying, you know, all the relatives come around the bed, if you have relatives. And you know, and it can be quite a, I guess it's painful on a physical level, but it isn't like a secret thing you go through. Some people it is, but for most people it's, people know that you're dying, unless it's a sudden heart attack or something like that. But in this inner death, it's a very, very private affair. Nobody else around you knows necessarily what is happening. So that makes it quite strange. Again, to quote Abu Sa'id, love whispered a secret in my ear. Now my mind is a fugitive, and my heart nowhere to be found in this ocean of pain. My secret will be a secret, the friend said. Your blood-stained shirt no one will see when the heart bleeds. No one will wake with your moan at night. The smoke from your heart burning in this fire, no one will detect. It is this really secret of lovers of God, this painful tearing apart of the veils, of all of your sense of self, your identity, your everything you believe in. And this is what really begins to separate those who are traveling on the road of intent, those who like the idea of being a Sufi, those who like the idea of being a lover of God. You know, you read Rumi and it's very beautiful and intoxicating, and you do the zikr with some friends and you go into a wonderful state, but you know, there comes the point when you have to start to pay, not with money, but you have to start to pay with what is most precious, your own self. And it hurts. It is, Al-Halaj says, the pain or the suffering is greater than the forces of created nature. Because you are really going against everything in this world. You begin this really process of blood and guts. And you can spiritualize it as much as you like. And usually that is an escape. That is why at the beginning it's wonderful to have those spiritual ideals and intentions. But there comes a point when they too become a veil on the path. Because it is really just dying is about dying. It is about paying with yourself, paying with what is most precious. And it gets, you know, it is like Rumi's poem of the chickpea that gets cooked, or you get ground down. It is remorseless. And if you have a good teacher and a good path, you know, and you really commit yourself, you are going to get ground down and ground down and ground down. And everything that you believed in, everything that you hoped for, goes. Yes, your sense of self, your identity, that goes initially. But then there are those kind of forgotten dreams you have inside of you that come to the surface. I hoped for this, I longed for that. And they, in this remorseless Sufi system, nothing is possible in love without death. You die and you die and you die and you die. And you have to have a sense of humor about it. Please, if you take it, if you don't have a sense of humor, you will become one of those sour-faced mystics. I know Christianity produced quite a few because somehow they don't emphasize the laughter element. But Sufis have always, you know, put a smile on the face, and you know, you go gladly to the gallows like Al-Halaj. If you're going to kind of do it with a sulk and a, you know, then you're kind of miserable. This is what you signed up for. Remember, at the beginning, you signed your name to die before you die. It's the only way to realize the truth while you are in this world. And so you do need this kind of crazy Sufi sense of humor. There is a nice... A nice poem Coleman Barks translated from Rumi. A lover was telling his beloved how much he loved her, how faithful he had been, how self-sacrificing, you know all of that. Getting up at dawn every morning, fasting, giving up wealth and strength and fame, all for her. You know, you've all done that. You know, you rise at 5, you do your prayers, you do your meditation, you fast, you don't buy the BMW you really wanted. You know, all of those little sacrifices you make. There was a fire in him. He didn't know where it came from, but it made him weep like a candle. And you know that fire of longing that makes you want something you don't deserve. And you cry. You don't even know why you cry. You cry. And the beloved says, "You have done well," she said, "but listen to me. All this is the decor of love, the branches and leaves and blossoms. You must live at the root to be a true lover." You see, that is all the decor of love. Remember that. "Where is that? Tell me." "You've done the outward acts, but you haven't died. You must die." When he heard that, he lay back on the ground laughing and died. He opened like a rose that drops to the ground and died laughing. That laughter was his freedom and his gift to the eternal. So we die laughing because we are killed in the most absurd, crazy ways. It isn't a glamorous death. You know, we're not like Al-Hallaj on the gallows with our limbs being cut off with hundreds of people stoning us. And nobody celebrates nobody writes gazelles about our death. It's usually done over the kitchen sink with the kids, with the husband, with the partner, in work, in this kind of, nobody notices, nobody celebrates this slow disintegration of oneself, this painful process of fana. As all of our beliefs, our worldly beliefs, yes, that is the decor of love. I say that is easy to give away, the desire for worldly success and fame, because, you know, you read it in the newspapers and you see how trivial it is. But then there are kind of the nitty-gritty things underneath, like the desire for spiritual success. Some of us dream of spiritual states. You'd be surprised. Ah, that state of peace. Doesn't the teacher look so serene? One day I will be like that. You know? Longing to be loved, yes. And one day that too goes. Everything is torn up. You know, torn up, shredded. Now we have these machines that do it. And then there is this kind of miserable self that is in the midst of all of it. And then that is stamped on. The teacher, the path, the beloved, just stamps on it with his big boots, squashes it. It wasn't worth much anyway. It was only 40 years of your life, you know, 20 years in school. And, you know, in America, you then have to pay for that 20 years in school for the next 40 years. So even when you've died, you're still paying the bill for that education, that sense of self-worth, or whatever it is you have treasured for so long. And we each do it in our own way. And it is exquisitely painful. There is no other way to, you know, it's nice to sit and talk about it. And what amuses me, I have seen people and they sit in the group for 8, 10 years and they do the meditation and they have spiritual dreams and they haven't begun to die. They have not yet made that commitment. That's why I always quote this Sufi idea, you get taken into the arena of love. And the arena of love. There is a moment in the destiny of the soul when you are taken into the arena of love. And as in the gladiatorial arena of olden times, Roman times, when the gladiators, when they came into the arena, they would look at the imperial box and say, Morituri te salutant imperator. Those about to die salute thee. And that is the sign of a Sufi. When you know that is your end, you are going to die. You are going to, all those beliefs, all those ideas, all those, I mean, what is so beautiful is the Sufis write such lovely poetry about it. And somehow you read it. I remember Coleman Barks saying one time that that Hallmark wanted some of his Rumi translations. And he said, but you know, I don't think this is the love you are thinking of, you know? This is a love about annihilation. And they say, you know, it is so beautiful because they say it with such lyrical poetry and such sweetness. And somehow you read it and you think, sounds wonderful. Until it happens to you. The time has come to break all my promises. Tear apart all the chains and cast away all advice. Dissemble the heavens link by link and break at once all lovers' ties with the sword of death. Put cotton inside both my ears and close them to all words of wisdom. Crash the door and enter the chamber where all sweet things are hidden. How long can I beg and bargain for the things of this world while love is waiting? How long before I can rise beyond how I am and what I am? That is when you say, okay, enough is enough, let's get down to business. How long can I rise beyond how I am and what I am before you can leave this kind of small self behind that seems so important and begin to realize what you really are, what human beings are really made of? It is. They are so, they are so incredibly beautiful. If you knew what you are really like inside, how your soul is singing the praises of God, how every prayer you make, every longing you cry, makes this light inside you shine. So that is the, you know, in whatever it is, you know, 20 minutes I've described this nicely, this whole process of dying that takes, well, it can be done if you are in like about, you know, 5 years of intense torture. But generally 20, 30 years is kind of a, really to do that work of the soul, 20 years is good going. It's good going. But as they say, we live in interesting times. And one thing I discovered a while ago is before somebody dies, and here I mean before somebody dies physically, at the end of their life, there is a time of grace. It's something that for some reason is not generally known. Particularly the last 2 years of somebody's life, when they are getting old, or even when they know they are going to die, because the soul knows when it's going to die, generally. There is a time of grace. And this is very, very, very important. What this grace means for the ordinary person who isn't living mystical life, is it means in that last 2 years, and even it gets very close to the end, there is more grace. You have a chance to clear up all the debris of your life, to do a certain penance, to do forgive yourself, to forgive others. And it can clear away so much that you have accumulated. It is infinitely, infinitely precious. It is, you can say things you have never said before but should have. I remember with my mother, she wasn't in the slightest bit spiritual woman, and I was there very close to the end, the last few days that she died, and my younger sister had really cared for her. And the last thing she said to my younger sister, she had never said in her whole life, "I love you." You know? And that was precious gift. Just said, "I love you." She'd never, English, we don't really show, you know, affection very easily, particularly upper middle class English, you know, just handshake, you know, but she said, "I love you." And somehow that was what was left in my sister's heart. It was beautiful. So there is this moment of grace. What does a moment of grace mean? What does a time of grace mean? It means the veils that separate the worlds is kind of lifted. You see, there is a whole world of grace. It is just up there. Well, it's not really up there because there is no up there. But it is just there. And most people are veiled from that world, which is why I always find it sad. People have to work so hard to do anything, because they have to do it by their own effort. Even spiritually at the beginning, you have to make a lot of effort. And, you know, to achieve anything in this world, it requires a lot of effort. You have to really discipline yourself. You have to make things happen. And there is this whole world of grace in which everything is given. That's why my sheikh said, how can there be an effort with divine things? They are given as a gift. Everything that actually really belongs to the human being is given. It is a gift. Yes, I suppose we have to learn how to receive it. We have to learn to be an empty cup. But even the emptying the cup is also grace, really. So there is this whole world of grace just waiting there to help us. But one of the difficulties, the dramas of being caught in the ego with all its illusions, with all its fantasies, with all its dreams and hopes and desires, you know what I mean, is that that kind of veils us from this world of grace. And so most people, except in rare instances, they don't have direct access to the world of grace. Sometimes it's like a trickle-down effect, but you know how it is even in political people. They say trickle-down effect doesn't always work. Somehow the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. And so most people, and even sadly, people when they get older, they seem to calcify. I don't know if you've noticed that. People, as they get older, they kind of, everything gets less flexible, not just physically, but also psychologically. But then, as the soul knows it is about to make this transition from this world, there is this moment, this time of grace, when the veils are lifted. And, say, people who generally wouldn't have access to that dimension, they are given it, and it lifts away many of the samskaras, many of the veils of illusion, many of the dross, the darkness that we have accumulated. You can forgive people, you can forgive yourself, things can fall away. I've seen it happen with, on a kind of quicker scale, with people, some people in our group who have had cancer. And as they, how it stripped away all this false self that they had struggled with for so many years and tried to work on and transform, and suddenly it was gone, and there is this pure human being left in the end. Very, very beautiful to see. It's a painful process, yes, if you have cancer, but it's worth it. It's worth it. But so there is this time of grace, and it is both to give you the opportunity, say, to clear away the mistakes you have made, not really mistakes, or the darkness you have accumulated, because in this world we kind of attract darkness to us. It's like in America, you attract stuff. It just happens. I don't know why. You have empty apartment and 5 years later you have stuff in your apartment. You can't help it, I don't think, unless you are really wise or really poor. And we do it not just physically, we do it psychologically, and you could even do it spiritually. You can attract sort of spiritual ideals and ideas, and they kind of... And really, one should go back to the other side as naked as when one came. So there is this cleansing process that happens through grace before you die physically. I think the last 2 years are particularly valuable. I suppose if you are going to get Alzheimer's or something, probably the last 2 years before the mind goes. I don't know, I haven't looked at that in detail. But there is a cleansing process, but there is also something else that is not even as well known as that, which is there is a possibility in that towards the end of the life to make a transformation. They say, you know, every life is a possibility for, on some level, transformation of the soul. So you don't go back to the same place you started at. And so you can make a step in your spiritual evolution, in the evolution of the soul, because I always say that is the real evolution, the real transformation is transformation of the soul, because that's what you take with you after you leave this world. And so for the ordinary person, even if they're not interested in spiritual life or a little bit, or interested in religious life, there is this possibility at the end to make a shift in evolution. And they are given, it's like there is grace there. There are even certain beings that from the other side that are there to help the human being to make the shift, so that they can make a step. So the whole life can have been another one step further on the road, the eternal road, which is the the path of the soul, which is, as you know, quite different to the path of the ego, to the self-development or all of that. This transformation of the soul. So that is what happens with ordinary people. Now, what is very, very interesting is we are at a time in evolution, in collective evolution, which is, and this is not news to any of you now, the end of an era. We are, you know, happily sailing on the Titanic. We all know that. We are moving the deck chairs or the dance or whatever, whatever image you like, and we are all on this very elegant, high-rise, ecologically unsustainable Titanic. Now, the Sufis, not just the Sufis, but all mystical paths, know there is this relationship between the macrocosm and the microcosm, between the individual and the whole. So Ibn Arabi says we are the lesser Adam and the whole is the greater Adam. This is this extraordinary relationship between the individual and the whole, that we mirror each other. The human being contains within him or herself the whole. So this is mystical truth. I don't have to explain it in detail because that's just how it is. And so just as we go through our individual life and death and transformation, so does the whole go through its life and death and transformation. And just as we have our cycles, so does the world have its cycles. And say, as many of you know, we are coming to the end of one cycle. We are in a civilization that is dying. Despite all its technological advances, it is dying. There's a certain something is not here that was here even 50 years ago. It's gone. And you can either say, oh, you know, the end is coming. The end is nigh. I think that's, you know. I remember as a child in London, you used to walk in Oxford Street and there'd be these people with these placards. What do they call, Gordon, those? Sandwich boards, that's right. And with the end is nigh written on them, you know? And just to remind you when you were shopping for new shoes or whatever it was, that the end is nigh. So we are, the end is nigh. We are, whether it's, you know, 1 minute to midnight or we've got 30 seconds left, or apparently the new thing is 2012. I was asked to write a chapter for a book about 2012, when according to the Mayan calendar, we still got a half an hour to go. It's all going to end or begin or something 2012. So you better start doing whatever you do, tidying your rooms. But if we are at the end of an era, the end of a civilization, why should it be different than the life cycle of the individual? Now, what that means is that it is a time of tremendous grace. It might not seem like it as you look around. But I remember years ago when I first began, I always told people I was very kind of not a New Age person. I was kind of traditional mystic and not interested in New Age things. But I remember this little image that I was shown years and years ago, 20 years ago, that it was very sweet. It said, the magical unicorns that only used to live deep in the forest were now visible in the city streets. The magical unicorns, because unicorn is, of course, a tremendous symbol of spiritual transformation. It is the horn of the unicorn. It's a great spiritual symbol of this masculine energy of transformation. That something that used to be deep in the forest is now in the city streets. People don't see it, of course, because they are too busy rushing around, listening to their talking on the cell phones and whatever people do. But there is a grace present. It is, and I think it is our responsibility as mystics to learn to work with that grace. Just as if you are with a relative, mother, friend who is dying, there are special prayers you can do when they are dying. There's a special way to help the human being to make that transition. Firstly, one of the great advantages of being a mystic, if you're working with an individual, is you are not afraid of death. And most people, for some reason, you know, because it's so much nicer on the other side. Somebody in our group in Switzerland, she was with her mother who was dying, and her mother kind of, at the very end, she kind of went. Sometimes, just before you die, you can go and come back. You don't just sort of go bump. You can go and come back. You're kind of halfway house for a little bit. You go and come back. And she went and she came back and she said to her daughter, Sabina, you will really like it here. And then she went. And, you know, because so many people in our culture, they are kind of constricted by the pressure. You know, it's like you're not allowed to get old in this culture. You're not allowed to die in this culture. You have to be a kind of teenager into your 60s. And, you know, there's all this pressure to be, you know, hiking and everything in your 70s and 80s. You're not allowed to sit on the rocking chair and let the days come and go. And people are frightened of death. So on an individual level, if you are with, you know, your parent or your friend who is dying, you can help them because as mystics, we are in the dying business. You know, if you haven't died already, if you haven't last, you know, been through that 20-year process, you've had a taste of it. You've kind of welcomed it somewhere. You said, what I want is to be free of this world and its encumbrances. I want to taste the truth of who I am. And the moment, it is very beautiful because the moment you say, I want to taste the truth of who I am, that first moment, you are given a taste of it. That's why the Nakshbandis say the end is present at the beginning. So we can help an individual to die. And later on, if you have really made the journey, you can actually be on the other side and on this side with somebody when they are dying. So you can kind of, and if you're not on the other side, you can definitely ask for somebody on the other side to help the person to make that transition. It is, I won't go into that now, but there are beings who help people on the other side. And, in, you know, we've had, our group has been around long enough in the West that, you know, there have been people who have died, who have gone to the other side. And it's busy life on the other side, you know. There's so much to do, lots of things to do. So it's not the eternal rest home. You don't get the, you know, whatever it is people hope for. But we can help people to die. That is, because we are not afraid of death, because we have tasted death, even if we haven't been through the whole process of fana. We have had a glimpse of it. We are not frightened of it. We welcome it. It belongs to our heart. It belongs to this pact of love we made with our beloved. I am here for your sake, and I am here to die before I die. So when we pray for somebody who is dying, we don't pray with the constriction that belongs to those who are completely attached to this world. It is like, for example, in our particular order, we are not a healing order. So we don't do healing practices, we do pray for people who need healing, but we always say that the greatest healing is death. That is in the Sufi tradition, the greatest healing is death, because then you are free, and you are completely free of this body. Which even when you have access to other worlds, while in this body, when you're in the state of Bhakka, abiding in God, after the stage of Fana, you arrive in the state of Bhakka, abiding in God. Even then, there are certain limitations, certain places you can't go, because if you went there, you'd be very difficult to come back. You wouldn't want to come back. So, we can help people to die, but let us take it another stage further. There is this moment of grace before somebody dies, this time of grace that can help them both to clear things up and to make this transformation. And that is also true for the whole. That is also true for our civilization. We are in a time of grace. If we can step out of our identification with crisis, with trauma, with the world is going wrong, or I've got to look after myself, we will find we are in a time of extraordinary grace. It's not easy to live in the time of grace. This is kind of, you think, oh, you just get grace. No, because you have to be able to bear the grace and to bear what grace brings with it, which means often there are things you have to look at you would rather not look at. This happens, say, before somebody dies, they have to look at things that they have avoided looking at all their life. You have to look at them. This also happens on the path. There comes a time you have to look at things you have avoided looking at, like right in your face. And grace brings them into your face. So this is a time actually of accountability for the world. It doesn't appear like that because we live in a culture that has practiced avoidance until it is an art form. There's this nice phrase, weapons of mass distraction. We are surrounded by so much distraction, we can never have to face anything because we are kind of moving on to the next distraction. But I think that as mystics, as those who, even if we have not completely died, have welcomed death, have made a contract with love about death, that we can align ourselves with this time of grace. We are not frightened, we shouldn't be too frightened about losing, you know, our material possessions. Because I know this culture places a lot of value on them, but if you've made just a few steps on the path, hopefully you have loosened your hold or their hold on you. You know, you've had a few garage sales. You've been to a few thrift stores. And one of the things you notice in this culture is people are terrified now that they might lose what they have. You know, that third SUV sitting in the driveway, whatever it is that brightens their days. And I think it's going to be hard. Any time of transition, certain things are lost and certain things are given. This is the law. It is. And what is interesting is it's not always the things you think will be of value in the next era are going to be of value. It's tricky. The beloved plays by his rules, not by our rules. Remember that. It's always good to remember that on the path, because each time you make a real step on the path, you suddenly find things you thought were important have no value at all on the next stage, and things that you thought, oh, loving my mother, I thought I had to get away from that. You suddenly find, on this level of the path, it is really important to value one's parents. There's a time you have to separate from the parents and claim something for yourself, and then there's a stage on the path where, you have to respect them. So it is, things shift each stage of the path. What you thought was important isn't necessarily important, just like there are times of effort and times of grace. But I am convinced that as mystics, we have a responsibility to help the world make this transition. That it is, why? Oh, who knows? Because we are idiots. Because we're his own personal idiots, and because we are used to being lost, because we belong to our beloved and not to this world. We are here in service to him, not in service to the world. That's very, very important. Most people are in service to the world. And there are people who do very, very good things for the world, ecologically, scientifically, medically, humanitarian. And they are in service to the world. That is their duty, that is their destiny. But we are in service to our beloved. It's a different set of rules. It's quite different. We are here for his sake, and he is trying to help his world evolve. His world to take a step from a time of darkness into the light. He is trying to help the world sing his song of remembrance again. And we are here to help it. We are here to offer our prayers to him in the midst of his world. And we are here to work with grace also. Because we know how to work with grace, because that's what we get to work with. That's how we learn to die ourselves. We can't die through our own efforts. My sheikh, he said, the ego cannot go beyond the ego, the mind cannot go beyond the mind. It has to be with grace. It has to be with the help of the superiors, with the grace of the tradition, with the grace of God. It is only that that will take you from here to there. Only grace. So we are used to working with grace. And just as we work with grace for our own transformation, so we can learn to work with grace for the world. And this is a time of tremendous grace. Most people say don't recognize it because they're so caught up in what is dying, what is not working, with the conflict, with all the difficulties that bombard us every day in the newspaper.